Hey everyone, my online course on the rehabilitation of the fitness athlete with Dan Pope is on sale this week. If you want to work with higher level fitness athletes and help people get back into the gym after an injury, this is the course for you. Head to MikeReynolds.com/fitathlete to learn more and sign up this week. On this episode of the Sports Physical Therapy Podcast, I'm joined by Dr. Jeff Dugas. Jeff's an orthopedic surgeon at Andrews Sports Medicine and the American Sports Medicine Institute in Birmingham, Alabama. Jeff's one of the pioneers of the new internal brace procedure for Tommy John repairs. It's an exciting new procedure that we've seen great results with so far and a faster return to pitching. In this episode, we're going to talk about the history of this procedure, the selection criteria, the benefits over traditional reconstruction, and so much more about Jeff's experience. Welcome to the Sports Physical Therapy Podcast. I'm your host, Mike Reynolds from MikeReynolds.com. Hey, Jeff, thanks so much for joining us on the podcast today. How's it going?
Great to be here, Mike. Thanks for having me. All's well.
You're one of the pioneers of this newer procedure, the internal brace procedure for ulnar collateral ligament repairs. And it's really awesome to see its growth over the last several years. And it's super exciting to have more options for our overhead athletes now. Why don't we jump right in and start talking about that? Can you explain a little bit about what exactly this new internal brace procedure is, and then maybe give a little context, maybe a little bit about the history of UCL repairs in general?
Sure. So I'll start with the history part because that gets us to the other part. But the, you know, Tommy John was a pitcher with the Dodgers and the Yankees. And in 1974, Frank Jobe, who's one of the pioneers of elbow surgery in our country and one of the real fathers of sports medicine, did his ulnar collateral reconstruction. And he swore that it was a total failure. He said, because Tommy John got an ulnar nerve palsy that didn't come back for 2 years and another operation. And so he basically said it was bad, and he didn't do another one for 5 years.
That's crazy.
And it's crazy. And Tommy John came back to win more games after his surgery than before. Lyle Norwood published the first study on this in 4 patients, and only 2 of them got back. But remember, back in the day when people were repairing things, Norwood was the first to publish on repair in 1981. And only 2 of them got back. That was before suture anchor technology advanced and suture technology advanced, before we really knew anything about the operation. So fast forward, John Conway, who wound up being the Texas Rangers doc for a long time and one of the more gifted scientists in the elbow world and practices in Texas, fantastic surgeon. He published when he was a fellow on Job's first 74 patients that he did reconstructions on. And Tommy John was the first one. And in that group, 75% of Major League Baseball players got back to Major League Baseball with reconstruction, but only 30% of the repairs that he did, 14 repairs, 7 major leaguers, and only 2 of them got back. So based on that, Jobe said repair was bad and reconstruction was good, which was right.
Right.
And then Andrews published in 2000 with Fred Azar, who was a fellow when he pulled the data together on his 90 patients or so. And he had the same outcomes, you know, 80 something percent of the elite baseball players got back, but only 30% of the repairs, because he had done some repairs early on, got back. So as of 2000, there were 160 patients that were published on reconstruction, which is hard to imagine. Over a 26-year period, we only published on 160 patients.
That's crazy, right? Considering how much I know Dr. Andrews alone did.
Right. I mean, and then over the next 10 to 15 years, the whole thing exploded. So 2000 is when I was finishing my fellowship, Lyle and I. And so we started and we were doing all these cases with Andrews, you know, hundreds of them, thousands over the course of 10 years. And we cut into these ligaments and we reconstructed all of them. And so we were doing a reconstruction for every one of these patients, regardless of what their level of pathology was. And some of these things, you cut into these ligaments and they're just not that bad. I mean, you look at these things, you think, gosh, it's a shame we got to do this 12-month operation for this high school kid. And of course, as the years went by, the ages got younger. It went from being a professional's operation, which was a lot of the patients in Jobe and Andrew's study, to you know, a smaller number over time. And now the vast majority of them are high school kids. So Andrews was pushing us to, you know, say, look, this is it's terrible. We have to do these things. So that was the genesis of it. And in that time frame, there were so much advancements in technology with suture anchors and tapes and suture technology and biologics and all these other things. Plus our understanding of the operation after doing thousands of these things with multiple centers across the country doing lots of these things. So a guy named Gordon Mackay, who was a foot and ankle surgeon in Scotland, was the first one to use the concept of the internal brace. And the internal brace is really a construct using two small plastic anchors with a tape, a suture tape, a fiber tape, which is spread between them. And we use the collagen coated fiber tape here in the U.S. because we can get it. Some places in Europe won't allow you to do any kind of collagen, but we can. So we use that. So that was the internal brace. And I remember going down to the company that made this, and they didn't think we could do it in the elbow using these small anchors. They thought the tape was too big. And I said, no, we can do this. And I went down there and I showed them in a cadaver, we could do it. and so then we proved that we could do it. And so that was the genesis of it. And then it was just a matter of doing some basic science studies, which we did, proved that it was at least as good as what we were doing every day. And then I had the right patient walk in, and we could talk about that if you want. But the right patient walked in and the summer of 2013, and we did the first one.
Isn't that amazing? Right. And, you know, to give a little history too, you know, you mentioned your fellowship in 2000. I just, you know, just to reflect on that too. You know, I don't think a lot of people know that, we were doing our fellowships at the same time. That was me down there in the PT world, right, and you and Lyle down there in the surgical world. So you brought back, right, some memories there, but you know, it's amazing, right, too. You also mentioned too, I remember when we were, you know, back in our fellowship days, in our early career days, remember like Tommy John's used to be like 35-year-olds that were towards the end of their career, right? Or, right, you know, 30-year-old, right, professionals in it. Now they're kids, they're high school kids, they're college kids. So, you know, to be able to do this.
They're junior high school kids now. It's terrible.
And I like what you really said right there, where you said like, sometimes you go in there and you're like, gosh, the tissue's not that bad. I wish we didn't have to do a full reconstruction. That's amazing. So, you alluded to this a little bit about, you know, the 12 month it takes in a Tommy John reconstruction. What are the main benefits of the internal brace? If it's a similar strength, what changes this? Like, why would you go an internal brace over a traditional Tommy John reconstruction?
Well, let me just say, as I start that, you know, thank God for Lyle Kane. You know, we've been side by side for a long time, and I think we get anxious when we're more than about 50 feet apart. So as you know, he's been a vital part of this. So I don't want to overlook saying that about Lyle.
Very true.
So, you know, a reconstruction means you're substituting for what was there, whether it's ACL reconstruction, UCL reconstruction, whatever. So you're putting a piece of tendon in and asking it to become a ligament. Tendon and ligament are similar, but they're not the same. And so when you put that tendon graft in there, it has to heal in the bone tunnels. And we know from Scott Rodio's, you know, studies in the 90s, how tendon to bone healing, tendon and bone tunnel, all these kind of things work. And so that tendon has to heal first, and then it has to undergo a process of ligamentization. So that tendon has to actually reorganize into ligament-like tissue to function like a ligament. A tendon would not survive in a ligament mode as a tendon.
Right.
And that's very different than the repair with the internal brace, where you have ligament and you're asking ligament to heal to bone, and then augmenting it. That ligament tissue is already ligament. It doesn't have to change, just has to heal. And that's really the major difference in the two operations. And we repair every other ligament in the body. There's no other ligament that we don't repair. And so as long as the tissue is good, and that's really what it boils down to with the internal brace, is if the tissue quality and quantity are there, if the ligament tissue itself is okay, it's just detached, you can reliably repair ligament to bone. And ligament to bone healing is very robust and reliable and reproducible. And so the augmentation with the internal brace, and I do think the collagen makes a difference. You're putting a backstop on this so we can rehab them quicker. And we did some studies looking at cyclic loads and all these kind of things to know that we could push these people. So we rehab them a little quicker. Kevin, you and everybody else that rehabs these things, I'm sure you would say the same thing Kevin does. The internal brace people get their range of motion back quicker.
Right.
They have less, it's less of an operation. There's less bleeding. There's less swelling. There's less pain. But they also get the range of motion back quicker. And that's because it's a very, very stable and rigid construct. So we can push them pretty quickly. We don't have to worry about pistoning and the tunnels and the graft not healing and things like that that we worry about with the reconstruction. So we have to go slower. So we were able to rehab them quicker, heal quicker, and become the tissue that it's supposed to be, which it already is, faster. And then it's just a matter of building up their strength, their endurance, and getting them back in the game. So
which
it
is
literally
amazing.
Cuts the rehab time in half.
Right. And that's, and I remember when you guys first started doing this, you know, Kevin and I, you know, we hopped on the phone and we were both saying, we're like, wow, like this seems really fast. We're kind of nervous. Right. And I think we're still nervous. Every time we go through the procedure, it's almost, we're still nervous, but I got to admit the outcomes have been fantastic. Right.
They have been. And I have to give a lot of credit to Buddy. Yeah. I got to give a lot of credit to Buddy Satwa, who's another one of the real geniuses of shoulder and elbow surgery. Today is Dr. Andrew's 80th birthday, and he was our presidential guest for the Fellowship Society this weekend. But, you know, Buddy is actually doing these and he's getting them back in 4 or 5 months.
Wow.
Which, you know, I think, you know, that's fine. We're probably pushing the envelope of what we can do rehab wise, but, I remember the very first one, they sent me a video. I think I showed you this. We did the surgery on August 8th, 2013. And on January 10th, they sent me a video of this kid pitching off the mound. And I thought, why are you trying to kill a good idea? It's going to fail and we're never going to do another one of these. This, why are you doing this? And I called the therapist and the trainer and I was like, what are you doing? They said, we can't hold him back. You know, he feels great. He's pitching. And and he went on to pitch his whole senior season in high school.
And isn't that historically, too, with like things like ACLs, like from the transition from the 80s to the 90s, where sometimes our advanced rehab progression was just feeding into the noncompliance of our patients, right?
Absolutely. Absolutely. I get texts and emails all the time about, hey, so-and-so hitting a game. I got one the other day where somebody was hitting in a game at 10 weeks post-op. And I was like, oh my God, I told you not to do that. You know, and they're like, oh, he feels great. He's hitting. I was like, okay. I mean,
I'm glad that you are also nervous when you hear things like that. But it's been great. And, you know, like you said, I mean, the concept of not having to go through the ligamentization process and then not having to, you know, deal with some of the issues like the bony tunnels healing and all those things. And it's really exciting. So rehab's faster. When do you let an internal brace start throwing? Let's start with that. When do you usually start that?
We'll be back after a quick break.
I hope you're enjoying the podcast episode. If you want to learn more from me, please check out my website, mikereinold.com. In addition to all my great articles, videos, and podcast episodes, I have a ton of online CEU courses, as well as my Inner Circle online mentorship and community. Be sure to subscribe to my free newsletter, where I'm always sending you great info and exclusive perks and discounts. Just head to mikereinold.com to get started. Thanks so much.
So my typical routine is I give them 6 weeks to heal in a brace. We get the range of motion back. We start them PT day 3, and we rehab them, keep them in the brace. 6 weeks, they come out of the brace. They start doing plyos. We do 4 weeks of plyos, starting with two-handed plyos for 2 weeks with gradual progression over that two-week period to the affected side. You know, we're basically going from 50-50 to 100% on the affected side. Then we do 2 weeks of one-handed plyos, gradually ramping up the intensity and things like that. So by the end of it, they're, you know, throwing a plyo ball off a trampoline, which is just like throwing. And then they start throwing programs. So we usually start the throwing program in week 11, start a week 11. And there's, you know, a couple of phases to that, as there always is. And generally speaking, it's about a 6 to 7 month total recovery time.
And total recovery, probably just because we have to get people off the mound and pitching again. So
right.
Position players would be even faster. Like, when do you let position players get back to?
I think most position players are back in about 5 months.
Right.
You know, those guys can hit. Usually you're hitting live by 4 months. We start the hitting progression at the same time. And the hitting progression is only 6 weeks. So they're done with the hitting thing by 16, 17 weeks. It's 4 months. So usually they're back hitting and you know, DHing or playing first base. You know, if they're a first baseman, they probably play in a game at 4 months.
Right.
You know, a left-sided infielder, probably 5 months. Outfielder, probably 5 months. Catchers, I've been a little bit more cautious with because they have to throw from so many angles. And they got to throw hard, and they're throwing all the time. So I think catchers and pitchers, probably about the same.
Right.
You know, interestingly, one of the groups that we're a little bit concerned about, and this is true for reconstructions too, is javelin throwers.
Right.
Javelin throwing is really not an easy one to get back to. And I think when we look the data up, the javelin throwers are probably not going to do as well in general, regardless of which procedure you do.
Right.
As the baseball and other overhead athletes.
Yeah, the torque's enormous with you know, such a large weighted implement. That's it's totally different, right? And to give the listener some perspective again too, I mean, we're starting to throw after a Tommy John reconstruction now at about month 5 now. So it's about 20 weeks
about
or so.
20 weeks.
And then 20 weeks. And they're getting, which is actually slower. We slowed that down, which I don't know, that's probably another topic of conversation, but you know, we've slowed that down from 16 to 20 because people were failing. I don't think that was necessarily, the fault of the procedure, but, and they're not back until give or take about 12 months. Some teams are even delaying longer, which again, I don't necessarily agree with, but you know, that's a big difference. Like you said, it's about half the time. And man, when you're talking about a collegiate athlete or you're talking about somebody with a very specific timeline, that is very impactful for them. And it is.
And I think that some of the data on return time obviously has seasonality built into it.
Right.
You take a fair amount of seasonality out of it when the total recovery time is half.
Right. Right.
Because you have so much time to make those decisions. Whereas if you get somebody hurt right now, at the pro level, they probably won't come back till the All-Star break.
You know,
they might not be back in April or May, even though they might be able to.
Right.
The pro teams, you know, the major league teams are going to be very patient with these things because they have an investment in these guys.
Right.
Whereas at the college level, you know, they're going to be pushing them a little harder because they don't have the time. High school kids don't have the time.
Right.
So, you know, the seasonality of it really makes a big difference in terms of that statistic.
Right.
So we always look at, you know, return time relative to seasonality, and seasonality is a much bigger factor in the reconstructions than the repairs.
Yeah, big time. And everybody has different goals depending on their level. I mean, at the professional level, we're often mapping out like a 2-year progression. That includes return time, but sometimes we delay them on the way back because we want them strong towards the playoffs or something like that. You know, it's just the timing of the procedure. So
exactly.
All right. So based on that, then somebody comes to your office and they see you. Who's the best candidate for this? Like, how do you make your algorithm, your clinical algorithm of whether you go for a full reconstruction or this new internal brace repair? Like, what goes through your mind?
Well, first, it's always their preference. You know, I work for them. They don't, you know, so I always say that, look, I work for you. You're hiring me to do a job for you. And my job has to be to achieve your goal. We have a shared interest. So my urgency, my recommendations have to be based on your goals, not my goals. And so I have people that come and they say, you know, whatever you do, I want the internal brace. I can look at them and say, yeah, your tissue looks terrible by MRI. I think that's a bad idea.
Right.
I've had people say that, like, I don't have time for the reconstruction. I want the repair. If it doesn't work, that's okay.
Okay.
I have other people that could look great for a repair and they're like, I'm not on a timeline. I want the gold standard. Just do the reconstruction. That's fine. It's their choice. It's their elbow.
Right. Right.
The vast majority of them come in and we consent them for both operations. And that's because while MRIs are good tests and it's the best test we have. So I think some of it starts with a good history, good x-rays and a good MRI, contrast, no contrast, whatever, just a good quality MRI, not a strip mall MRI, you know, not one where the person is trying to escape the magnet. You can't see anything.
Right.
But a good quality MRI. So if you get good imaging and good x-rays and get a good history, you can get a pretty good feel. I think we've been about 92% accurate in saying what procedure we're going to do if we have the option of doing either. So that's there's great. About 1 in 10 or 12 or so that you change based on what you see when you're in there. Because ultimately it has to be based on what you see and feel. And so I think good quality imaging is what you're looking for. And on the imaging, if it looks like the tissue is healthy and it's just detached, which is a lot of these, they're good candidates for the repair. And in our study that we published, and this was the early, you know, 130 of these, there was no difference whether it was proximal or distal, partial or complete, did a nerve transposition or not. None of those things made a difference in the outcomes. So there was no reason to shy away from doing whatever we felt was best at the time.
That's great. That's great. So the number one thing is tissue quality. It has to have the right type of tissue quality. So if it's too degenerative, it's probably not going to take, and you're going to go full reconstruction.
Correct.
Right. And then
or quantity, you know, if somebody's got a big ossicle in their ligament and, you know, like a big former avulsion or something where they're, you know, they pulled something off when they were 10 or 11, there's a big piece of bone. And when you cut it out, they're going to have a deficiency. Those people need more tissue. They need more collagen.
Right.
So if you have a deficiency of either quality or quantity,
right,
we're probably doing a reconstruction.
That makes sense. And that's probably why, you know, with the mean age of people needing these procedures getting younger and younger, that probably means the tissue's better. So we're going to see more potential candidates. Is that accurate?
I would say that's very accurate. You know, the UCL world is probably 70% high school kids.
Right. Yeah. That's crazy. So can you share with us what have been the outcomes so far? I know you've probably studied this and seen some of the most in the country. How many have you performed, give or take, now? And what do you think the outcomes have been so far compared to Tommy John?
We've done about 600 of these in Birmingham over the 9 years we've been doing it. And it's accelerating. I'll probably do, you know, somewhere in the neighborhood of 200 of these this year. So it's accelerating, which is expected, you know. I would say that around the country, there's probably been somewhere between 3,000 and 4,000 of these done. Some of the other studies, Buddy published on 40 or 50 of these and had about the same outcomes we did, about 93% good and excellent return to play at the same or higher level, you know, those statistics that we have to track. And it's been the same. So everybody seems to be reporting kind of the same numbers, somewhere in the low 90s. If you look at standard reconstruction, and these are data from, you know, Andrews and Job and us, we published that big study on, you know, 1200 of these things. It's about 85 to 88% good to excellent return to play at the same or higher level. And I tell people those statistics and everybody says, well, we want the repair. And I say, look, that's not how you should look at it, because remember, we're cherry picking.
Right. Exactly.
And we're cherry picking the ones that are less injured, less tissue issues. No, you know, I don't have to take off a big piece of bone. And, you know, the only thing holding the elbow together is a graft and, you know, stuff like that. So I think that it's not fair to compare them and say one is better than the other. That was never the goal, and nor should it be. Reconstruction is still a great operation. And in people with good, healthy tissue, I'm sure it's higher than 85 to 88. But in the studies we have looking at all comers, those are the numbers. So I don't necessarily think it's a fair comparison.
Do we have any assessment on longevity yet of these? Any idea?
We're looking that up now. So we're looking up the 5 to 7 year results. You know, the real acceleration of this happened around 2016, 17. And so if you look at the numbers, as you'd expect, it just keeps growing and getting bigger. So we will probably publish the 5 to 7 year results, you know, minimum 5 year follow-up, probably in the next 2 years. Probably when we get to about 10 years total experience, we'll publish the 5 to 7 year data. We're collecting it now, and it looks about the same. It still looks like it's about 93%, which is what you would expect. But, you know, then you got to look into, you know, how long are these people playing? And that has a lot in it, because a lot of these high school kids wash out. They don't have the opportunities, or they're not good enough, you know. And so one of the things we have to ask is, were you able to pitch to the level that you, was your elbow the reason you didn't go further, or was it something else? And that's going to really play into the numbers in that. But we've got them all the way up to the major league level. Most of the major league clubs are now comfortable with this. A lot of the agents are comfortable with it, the players. But, you know, there's still no room to say that reconstruction is a bad operation now. Right. Interestingly, Dr. Andrews, on this panel we had this weekend with Kevin and me and Buddy Savoy, Lyle, and we were all sitting there and we were talking about all this. And Dr. Andrews said that he thinks it will not be long before every UCL surgery is done with internal brace.
Wow.
And we were talking about hybrids with, you know, reconstruction with the internal brace and all that. All of us are kind of nervous about putting extra tunnels in the bone doing that.
Right.
Some people are doing it and the outcomes will be, you know, some people around the country are doing that. Personally, I think it seems interesting, but I don't know that it's going to make it better.
Right.
There will probably be some studies published on that. I think it'll be at least as good, but I'm a little nervous about drilling extra holes in the bone and creating some more stress risers, especially on the medial epicondyle side.
Right.
But
especially, you know, with the internal brace doing so well, I don't know if we've warranted a need for that yet. It's not like the internal brace is failing on its own with just a repair.
No, right. We rarely see somebody tear the tape. I've seen, you know, maybe in my almost 9 years of doing this, I may have seen two or three.
Right.
People tear the tape. In fact, one of them, two of them out of the maybe three that I've seen tore the tape and the ligament, but it was on the opposite end of their initial injury. And it was like 4 years after the fact.
Crazy. Right. And revisions, who knows what led into that? Yeah.
Right. And revisions, you know, revision UCL surgery is probably one of the least successful operations I've ever done. You know, there are things that we do in medicine that work really well. And anytime you're revising, you wouldn't expect it to be as successful as the primary, but
right.
Revision UCL is really one of the worst operations in the history of sports medicine with a success rate of like 40%, you know, I mean, it's really bad and it's a hard operation to do and it takes forever. I think at the major league level, the average return time was like 21 months.
Yeah,
so it's
terrible.
A forever operation. It's terrible.
Right.
And so right now, most of us are revising previous reconstructions with internal brace. And revising failed internal braces with reconstruction because you don't have any bone problems. So you can do it like a primary.
Right.
And so those seem to be revision now seems to be a better operation because we have the internal brace as an option post reconstruction.
Hey, and the people we've seen, I mean, I've two of them right now. The people we've seen are doing great. So, you know, the future's bright and it's people like yourself pushing the envelope and a lot of your colleagues, you know, Dr. Kane and everybody that's really helped in this procedure. So, you know, thanks for doing all this. And Jeff, thanks so much for taking the time to share your experience with this and heck, I mean, 200 this year. I mean, there's no person that I probably want to talk to more than you because, you know, with that much volume, you're seeing a wide spectrum of people. It's a great experience to share with everybody. So thanks for taking some time out today to share that with my listeners.
My pleasure, Mike. It's great to see you and obviously keep doing what you're doing. I appreciate all that you do. You're one of the real scientists in what you do and you're leading the field. And between you and Kevin and people like Russ and others, you know, I mean, it's just we don't get there without you guys. You know, Andrew said this and we always say it, I can do a perfect operation, but if we don't get the rehab, it's going to fail. We only give them an opportunity and you guys are vital to what we do and the outcomes we get. So I appreciate you. You've been a real pioneer in the rehab of this, and I really appreciate your work.
Yeah, thanks. And for any orthopedic surgeons that may be listening, because we do have those too, I want you to notice how in tune Jeff is with the rehab process, right? I mean, he was listening that out as if he was the PT working with the person every day. So it takes a team, it takes a collaborative effort, and, you know, getting to even do podcasts like this just shows, you know, your willingness to do that. It just helps outcomes. And that's what we're doing it for, is right? And trying to maximize people getting back to what they love. So thanks again, Jeff.
Absolutely.
We really appreciate it. Hopefully get you on a future episode.
Happy to do it, Mike. Take care.
Thanks so much for listening to the podcast. If you enjoyed this podcast, please subscribe, rate, and review us on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, or wherever you listen to your podcast. And please share this with your friends to help spread the word. It would really mean so much to me. Please check out all my online courses, articles, newsletter, and more at MikeRano.com. There's always a ton of great perks for my newsletter subscribers. And also be sure to search for my other podcast, The Ask Mike Reinold Show, where my team of physical therapists, strength coaches, and I answer your questions. See you on the next episode.